How are you, Russ? Okay.
Every night I think, every time I come here, I say, this is going to be the last time. This will be the last time. I can't miss this class. It's just too good to miss.
So we're studying Pele Yoetz, as you know. And I have these pages here if you want to take a page. We're looking in the Alephs, you know, the whole book is organized according to the alphabet. So in the Aleph, he has something called Emet. And there was one thing in that long piece. Again, we're not going through the whole piece. Tonight we're going to focus just on one dimension. He says the following. Asur la adam lomar lo chatati. A person is not allowed to say, I didn't sin. Ulevakesh toanot, and he looks for excuses, his, what we call alibis, lenakot etzmo, to cleanse himself, to claim that he's not responsible. Betanot shav, with arguments that are really meaningless. He makes up arguments and excuses. So that's the subject of our discussion for at least the first part of tonight. And that is a person who is unwilling to blame himself and face the truth that he or she was guilty and was deficient, but rather comes up with all sorts of excuses. So what we're going to study tonight are various statements of the giants throughout the ages, focusing our attention on this aspect of humanity, on this tendency, if you will, or attitude on the part of man, instead of blaming himself, to blame others. This goes back to the dawn of creation, this natural tendency of man. For example, when Hashem says to Adam Rishon, why did you eat from the Eitz Hadas? So he right away points to his wife, and he says, Aisha Asher Nasati Imadi, this is the woman you gave me. He's not willing to take the blame for himself. He has an alibi. Now, one of the great Sfarim that was written about 3 centuries ago is called the Bino Le'itim. And he writes that the key to unlock the mystery of this phenomenon lies in a pasuk in Tanakh, in Yirmiyahu HaNavi. Yirmiyahu says the following, and we have to read this pasuk very carefully. Hineni nishpat oscha, al imrascha lo chatasi. Now, let me translate this to you first without being sensitive to the grammatical form of the word nishpat. Just in general. God says to Yirmiyahu, I will judge you based on your statement, I did not sin. In other words, when you denied sinning, that's when I judged. However, that's not the accurate translation of this pasuk. It says, Hineni Nishpat. Now, in Hebrew, we have 2 conjugations of the word Mishpat. We have it in an active sense, which means to judge someone, and that would be Shofet. So, for example, if I'm talking in first person, I would say, Ani Shofet Oscha. And that would seem to be appropriate for this pasuk, because God is saying, I will judge you because you denied that you sinned. And then there's something called causative, right, which is otherwise known as nifal. Nifal means, instead of my being active, I cause you to do something. And that's the word nishpat. Nishpat means, not that I judge you, but that I became judged. As if God was saying, I'm on trial. And that's why you're going to be punished. The reason why you're going to be punished is because you put me on trial. Says the Imre, says the Bina Le'itim, what does it mean when God says you put me on trial? Ha'adam, man comes to claim and to complain and to object, why is it that God you punished me? So first man says, I didn't sin. But then he asks himself, but there was something was done that wasn't proper. So then he says, you know what? God, you had no right to punish me. I had all the excuses in the world. And in a sense, what he's doing is he's putting God on trial. Why? He's blaming God for falsely accusing him. What? Are you okay, Aura?
Yeah.
Oh boy. I hope you didn't get hurt there. You're going to sue us for damages here, right? So a person who denies sin then turns to Hashem and he blames God for punishing him for no reason at all. Why? Because he's not willing to confess that he's guilty. He's not willing to point the finger at himself and take the blame. So then God had no right to punish him. So basically he's putting God on trial. That's what Hashem tells Yirmiyah by using the word nishbat. God says, you know why I'm going to punish you? Because when you denied that you sinned and you recited the famous sentence, lo chatasi, I became a nishbat. You caused me to stand on trial, as if to say that I was not acting out of justice. And one of the greats of all time, his name was Rav Shaul Natazon, he wrote a book called Sholem Meshiv. He says that vidui, which means confession of sin, is made up of one word. And that's the primary word. Again, we say a very long vidui, but you can collapse and reduce vidui to one word, namely chatasi. Chatasi means when you're willing to take the blame. Instead of pointing to Hashem and saying, God is at fault, God is punishing me when I don't deserve, I was not guilty, there was no crime that I committed. Once you utter that one word, chatasi, then you're admitting that you sinned and God is just. And when the pasuk says, Veheshiv es hashomo berosho, what does it mean? That's a pasuk at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. It means that he points the guilty finger at himself. What we want to study tonight is a beautiful presentation of one of the contemporary Rashi Yeshiva. His name is Rav Baruch Mordechai Ezrachi. And Rav Mordechai Ezrachi is a Rosh Yeshiva of a yeshiva called Ateres. Maybe you've heard of it. It's in Beit Vegan. And it's a yeshiva which is very much along the style of the Chevron yeshiva, which is considered one of the premier yeshivas in our time here in the land of Israel. In any event, Rav Ezrachi...
Is this a Sfardi yeshiva?
No. There is a great Sfardi yeshiva called Kol Yaakov, which is next door. A gigantic yeshiva. This is a pure Ashkenazi yeshiva. It's called Ateres. And the Rosh Yeshiva's name is Rav Mordechai Ezrachi. Don't you forget that. Okay, because he's really one of the greats. He's one of the amazing speakers also.
Is Ezrachi a Sephardi
name? No, it's not. Avraham Avinu was not necessarily a Sephardi. Maybe he was. His name was Ezrachi also.
Well, he was from War Kostim, so...
Maybe he was a Sephardi. Anyway, let's learn, without getting sidetracked in Sephardim or Ashkenazim, because we love all Jews, although I have to tell you, Rav Baruch Ezrachi is an Ashkenazi, but that's irrelevant. Just judge him by what he says. And I think this is a very beautiful presentation in a very contemporary Hebrew. He says the following. What happens when a chote, when a sinner, says lo chatasi? And that's the pasuk in Yirmiyah that we studied. Lo chatasi, he denies having to sin. How does that come about? After all, is he denying the reality? Is he changing the facts on the ground? Is he claiming that this action and this occurrence never happened? Is he just simply, in a state of denial? Lav Dafki says, it could be very well that he recognizes exactly what happened. He knows all the facts on the ground. He knows them very well. And he knows that a sin was committed. But nevertheless, he yells and screams, Lo chatasi, I didn't sin. Again, he knows the facts on the ground. He knows that he committed a sin. He knows that he was the person who did the action. And yet, paradoxically, he claims, Lo chatasi, I didn't sin. Hayitachin? How do we reconcile this? And the answer is, because he peels off of himself all of the guilt of the sin. He comes up with a thousand and tens of thousands of excuses. And they all come to say one thing. I don't have any chet. I don't have any ashoma. I am not guilty. He hides behind a veil of blaming all sorts of factors externally outside of himself. He refuses to take upon himself responsibility for his actions. In effect, what he's saying, I'm not responsible for this sin. It happened, but it happened for this reason, for that reason, this is the cause of the sin, that's the cause of the sin. But it goes even beyond that. It's not enough that he finds excuses to remove his responsibility. But more than that, he places the responsibility on the shoulders of others. There is responsibility, but it's not my responsibility. There's someone else who's responsible. And this is something that the human being tries over and over again, sometimes fooling himself, to point the finger of responsibility to someone else. This is the way the Satan perhaps tricks us and has us convinced that we can shift the responsibility over to someone else. So when a person says lo chatasi, it's one of two possibilities. Either he's just saying stam, I'm not responsible, there are other causes that were kaviyachal beyond my control, or alternatively he's saying there is responsibility here, but it's not my responsibility, it's someone else's. And therefore at the end of the day, whether it's this way or that way, he comes up with the claim lo chatasi. And this is his sin. The sin is lo chatasi. When he shirks responsibility and he's not willing to take responsibility for his actions, whether he does it this way or that way, that itself is a sin. In fact, that might be a sin that's even more burdensome and more strict and severe than the sin itself. Because basically he's saying, I deny responsibility. Let's take the case of Cain. Cain murdered his brother Hevel. HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Cain and says to him, Ei Hevel Achicha, where is Hevel your brother? And Cain responds, I don't know. But he adds the following words, HaShomer Achi Anochi, am I responsible for my brother? After all, you God, that's the implication, you're responsible for all your creatures. You created them. You should be protecting them. And you're asking from me, where is Hevel? You're the one who's in charge of protecting your creatures. And here Rav Mizrachi gives a beautiful metaphor, a beautiful mashal. Imagine, a ganav, a professional thief, steals vessels at night, and he doesn't get caught. The next morning, the security guard grabs onto the ganav and he says to him, why did you steal these kelim? So the ganav, the thief, responds, I didn't give up my umnus, my trade. I was very loyal to my trade. But you had a different trade. You were trained to watch and protect. Why did you leave your trade? Why did you forsake your responsibility? And now you're telling me I'm the thief? Cain says the same thing. You want to tell me that I killed Hevel? You created the Yetzirah in me. And that evil inclination brought me to murder. And you're the Shomer, you're the ultimate security guard that's in charge of everything. And you let me kill him? You're the one who killed him. You're the one who's responsible, he turns to God. He says, Ilu kibalta karbani kimoso, had you accepted, received my sacrifice, the way you received the sacrifice of Hevel, I wouldn't have gotten jealous. So God, you planted jealousy in my heart, and you should have protected me from that jealousy, and therefore you're responsible and not me. What is the God of basically claiming? What is his justification? He's shirking responsibility for his actions. Not only that, he's going beyond that. He's pointing to someone else and saying he's responsible. Look how distorted his claim is. It's so forged. It's such a counterfeit. But that's the nature of man. Man refuses to accept responsibility. Instead, he blames others. What does Cain say? Well, God, I'm not responsible here. You created me with this evil inclination. You caused me to be jealous of my brother. and you should have been protecting Hevel or organizing the universe in such a way that such a thing wouldn't happen. So Cain wants to completely shirk his responsibility. It's unbelievable. The man is a deliberate murderer, but he's not responsible. And what's more frightening here and more amazing is that he turns to God and he says, God, you're the one who's responsible. You're the true murderer, not me. Says Rav Ezrahi, the truth is that what man is, by his very essence, is responsible. The Mishnah tells us in the Masechta Bava Kamma that a man is always considered mu'ad. He's always guilty for damages that he perpetrated. And it doesn't matter whether he's awake, whether he's asleep, whether he did it deliberately or he did it accidentally. He has to be super careful about himself. That's the ultimate responsibility that defines the nature of man. But man is not willing to be a man. Because if the essence of man is responsibility, a man wants to say, I'm not responsible. And therefore, he's basically saying, I'm not man. And therefore, he comes up with all sorts of distorted explanations and justification as long as he can blame others without blaming himself. This is what Yirmiyahu hears in the Pasuk, Hineni Nishpat. Nishpat means God says, you're making me into the one on trial. You're pointing the finger of accusation at me when you say, Lo Chatasi, I didn't sin. Let's embellish this even further with the insight of Reb Lev Chassman, one of the great Bali Musar of the last generation. We have a parasha called the Egla Ruf. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's in Sefer Dvarim in Parashas Ki Tetzeh. And what happens is they find a slain body between two cities. And the entire parasha requires that the Zekanim, the elders of the city that's closest to where the body was found, come down and they claim, we did not cause his death. But the Torah says that this entire enterprise called Egla Rufa only applies in the following scenario. Lo noda mihi kahu. We cannot identify who the murderer is. So Rav Lev Chassman says, I don't understand. We have a kal vachomer. Imagine in the case where we don't know who the murderer is, and yet the zkenim, the elders, have to take a certain element of responsibility, and they have to implement the parasha of Egla Rufa. How much more so should that happen if we do know who killed him? The zkenim may have been responsible. Says Rav Lev Chassman, you see from this that if we know exactly who was guilty of this murder, then you know what? No one has to atone for the sin except for the murderer himself. Somebody committed murder, and that person is known. If we can identify him, he's the one who has to take the punishment for that sin. And he goes back to our pasuk in Yirmiyah. The Navi says, Hineni nishpat oschal imrascha lo chatasi. If he hadn't said lo chatasi, if he hadn't denied that he was guilty, there wouldn't have been a mishpat. Now, I don't get it. The mishpat is because of his sin. Why are you telling me that the mishpat is because he denied the sin? He said lo chatasi. And the answer is the following. Had he said the word chatasi, had he been willing to take the responsibility, then he would have achieved kapara. He would have atoned for his sin. And Hashem would have spared him of the ultimate judgment. Kapara depends upon, primarily, hakaras hachet, a person acknowledging sin and willing to take responsibility. He says, since behakara, once he recognizes his sin, he has harata, he regrets his past, he tries to resolve not to do it again, he says chatasi, and therefore he confesses his crime, which is called vidui. But in contrast, if a person says lo chatasi, then he angers God, and he'll be judged for that. Because
what are you saying? Mishpat?
Mishpat. Mishpat means judgment.
Mim, shein.
Pei, tes.
Tet.
He says the following. In the case of the Egla Rufa, we don't know who's responsible. B'nei Odom Misnachamim V'Yomer B'Libam Shalahoy Kan Retzach Elameis Misa Tivis. If we don't know that there's a murderer, we haven't identified him, then people have a tendency of saying, you know what, this person probably died a natural death. Today we have forensic medicine. But who says that he was murdered? Maybe he just died of a heart attack. And therefore...
The bullet wound is came naturally.
So obviously it's a push, but people will believe anything. This is what's called in psychology today cognitive dissonance, if you're familiar with that term. People deny anything. So we found the slain body. We don't know that he was murdered. We haven't found the murderer. Probably he wasn't murdered at all. Probably just died a natural death. Just as the knife was going through his heart, he died of a heart attack. I don't know what.
Or the wound was caused by animals.
Or maybe it was caused by animals. You could blame it on any sort of natural event. And not only that, even if he was murdered, maybe it wasn't a Jew who murdered him. Therefore, because we don't know, and we're willing to deny that there was a murder here that they were guilty of, the Torah commands us in the mitzvah of Egla Rufa, because we're not willing to recognize that there was a sin that was done, there was a terrible, hideous crime, and maybe we were responsible. So the Torah gives us the mitzvah of Egla Rufa, and we need Slicha and Kapara. But if we know who killed him, be ofen tivi mit'orat tsar, then we have a natural response of anguish, because innocent blood was spilled and human life was taken. And because of that sense and experience of tsar, we don't have to awaken a person and have him bring the Egla Rufa. But if we don't know who killed him, and therefore we're going to wash our hands clean and say he probably wasn't even murdered, that's when the Torah commands us in the midst of Egla Rufa to awaken us to a sense of responsibility. If you take a look at number 4, there's a sefer called Yalkut HaGershuni. This is a commentary on the Agadot of Shas, and very often he has early sources that we don't have. And he says the following. The Piskei HaTosfos in Masechta Tainis writes that Talmid Chachamim called Eched Modil Chavero Bein Al Emes Bein Al HaShekher. A Talmud Chacham, a true Torah scholar, will confess to his friend whether it's true, meaning whether the accusation is true, or even if it's a false accusation. And he ends up by saying, "Vehu tabua ma'ot." It makes no sense. Why would a person confess if he knows that the entire proposition, the entire accusation is false? To explain that, we're going to take a look at the insights of one of the great Canadian rabbis, in a sefer that's called Mishnas Avram. It's a commentary on the Sefer Chasim. And he says the following. Yiduim divrei ha-piskei ha-tosfos b'tainis t'talmidei chachamim kol eched modil chaver ben al emes uben al ha-sheker v'utamua. What does it mean that a person confesses even on a false accusation? He says the following. V'pashtus, it seems to me that if we take the simple approach, we should come to the following conclusion. Now, in order to appreciate what we're about to learn, I'd like to share with you a story about the great Noam Elimelech, which you'll see here in number 6. He was Rabbi Elimelech Milozhinsk. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's one of the great shining lights of Hasidus. And he once made the following comment, and his disciples quoted him. He said about himself, "I know that I'm going to go to Olam Haba." Why? Because when I get up to the high courts, the heavenly courts, they're going to ask me, "Did you study Torah?" I'm going to say no. They're going to ask me, "Is Palalta, did you pray?" I'm going to say no. They'll ask me, "Kiyamta mitzvahs vasisa ma'isim tovim?" I'm going to say no. And then they're going to say, "Hincha dover emes, you're telling the truth. And because you spoke the truth, therefore we're going to give you a chelek, a portion, in the world to come." So imagine, he really did learn Torah. He really did do great mitzvahs. He performed a great dedication to Torah study, but he's going to say lo. Why? Because he realizes that no matter what he did, it was never enough. And so that even though there's a false accusation, he's going to say emes. There's always truth to every accusation. And because he said emes, paradoxically, he's going to guarantee himself a place in the world to come. Let's go back to the previous paragraph from Rav Avraham Price. And he says the following. Shnei yonim nifradim. Yesh shetamud chacham omer dvar locha amiti chavero shomea umodolo v'yomolo mashamarta hu dover amiti. V'yesh shetamud chacham omer, I'm just reading it through and then we'll translate it. Omer divrei Torah sheinam amitim svar sheinam amitis. It has a pircha. Hashomea omelo liyosu tamud chacham mashamarta eno emes. The also Talmud Chacham Mevin Shahat Sedekim Chaveru Modeh V'Omer. The next word is a little bit rubbed out. I can't read it. Just let's see if I can figure it out. Chareini bi. Oh, maybe it should say Chazarni bi. Udvarim Shamarti Einim Tzodkim Zen Nikra Modeh Al Hasheker. He says there are two scenarios. Scenario A, the Talmud Chacham says a Dvar Torah, Dvar Loch, and his friend who listens says, you know what? What you said is truth. I agree with everything you said. It's absolute truth. Scenario number two, the same Talmud Chacham says to his friend a Dvar Torah, and his friend says, it's not true, because I have a question, I have a contradiction to it. So his friend says, you're right, what I said is wrong. And so that's what the Piskei HaTosis means, when he says kol echad modil chaver bein ala emes bein ala sheker, it means that sometimes you agree that what was said was true, and sometimes you confess and you admit that what you said was false because you've been proven false with an absolute contradiction. And that's what the Piskei HaTosis means, that a Talmud Chacham is modal emes and modal sheker. So from the perspective of Rav Price, the statement of the Piskei HaTosis has nothing to do with confession, but rather has to do with the truth or lack thereof of Torah. And a person should always admit if his Torah is not true, it's not what we call in Yiddish oisgehalten, and it doesn't stand up to all the attacks that what he said is incorrect. The last story I want to tell you, I've told you in the past, I'll tell it again, about the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, we have a picture of him here, if you want to see it, he was dedicated to truth. Truth to the extreme. And one time, okay, so every day in his court, they daven mincha exactly at 12:30, which is called mincha gedola, in the middle of the day. And that would be whether it was a weekday or whether it's Shabbos. One time they couldn't get a minyan. And it was 12:30, 12:35, 12:40, 12:45. At 12:45, 15 minutes later, they found a tzenter, as we call it, the ten for a minyan. And Rav Shmuel Greinerman, who was the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, turns to the Chazon Ish and he says, look, I invited to my house someone to meet with me at 1 p.m. But now, if we're going to dab mincha at 12:45, there's no way that I'll be on time. And I won't be able to make it for that meeting on time. The Chazon Ish said, what's the question? You must go to the meeting. You cannot join us for the mincha. And as a result, they didn't have a minyan. So the Chazon Ish said, it's worth living up to your commitment and to truth, even at the expense of forfeiting a minyan. And at the end, that's exactly what happened. They only had 9 men. Now I want to go on to a second topic. I'm just looking at my watch. Oh, excellent. We're halfway through, so we're doing good. And let me just get the photocopies for you. So we were doing Os Aleph tonight in the Peleoit, which is Emes, and a commitment to truth. Now we're going to Os Beis. And in Os Beis, we have a discussion called Ba'alei Chayim. So I'm going to give this out if anybody would kindly just pass it around. That would be helpful. The Peleoitz writes the following. Amru Rabosenu, he quotes a Gemara in Shabbos. Sar Balechayim Do'oraisa. The Torah itself commands us regarding Tsar Balechayim. If an animal is suffering, we have to take responsibility. We're enjoined from causing any pain to any creature, to any animal. That's called Tsar Balechayim. And this Gemara in Masechet Shabbos is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. The Iser Tsar Balechayim. The Torah itself prohibits us from causing anguish to any living creature, any animal. The Adarav, and even more so, if we can spare the animal of any pain, meaning we didn't cause the pain, but the animal is in a state of pain, but we can protect the animal and save the animal from pain, we're obligated to do so. Does this apply only if I own the animal? It's my pet dog? Afil shel hefker, even if it's ownerless. Afil shel nachri, if the animal is owned by a non-Jew, it's irrelevant. We have responsibility towards the animal. Ach, however, im heim mitzarim li adam, if the animal is causing pain to a human being, alternatively, tzarech adam lahem lirefuah, if he can extract from the body the flesh of an animal some sort of a healing process, or l'shar dover, or whatever we need it for, then mutter will allow even lahargam, even if we have to kill an animal. V'ein choshishin l'tzaron, and we don't have to worry about that tzar. Shariat Torah hitir shchita, the Torah allowed us to slaughter an animal and take its life for the sake of feeding a human being.
So if an animal kills a human being, we're supposed to kill the animal.
That's also true. Yeah, that's a different piece in the Peleoids. But right now he's talking about our relationship to the animal. And again, if we can spare a human being and protect him from an animal that's attacking, then we can even kill the animal if we have to. And if we need the animal for either a fuah, which means for health purposes, to extract some sort of a drug, or alternatively, if we need an animal for food, then the Torah says you're allowed to shech the animal. Lachain, therefore, muto limrot notzots mi avozos, we're allowed to rip out what they call in English feathers, right? We're allowed to rip out feathers from a duck. Why? Heyos in Elo Notzacheres. Now in the old days they used to use a feather as a fountain pen, I guess you'd call it. Do you know what I mean? I guess there's a fancy word for it, I'm not sure what it is, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
In fact, even the scribe who wrote a Sefer Torah, he wrote it with some sort of a feather, a notza, it's called in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
He says though, even though we're allowed to take these notzos, according to strict law, ha'olam nimnoim nishumat zorius. The general accepted minog is not to do so, because it causes the animal pain. So if you could somehow use a anesthesia or something along that line, a local anesthetic, that would be okay. But the minog is, as a general rule, we don't rip out feathers from the live duck or whatever the peacock, whatever the animal is, because it's causing it pain. And that's avzorius. That means we're doing something cruel.
So shech the duck, eat it, and before you cook it, take its feathers.
Correct. Again, once it's dead, then you can take the feathers, because it's not causing it any pain. But are you allowed to rip out the feathers from a live bird? The answer is technically yes, because you need it. But the minig is, it's uxorious, it's cruelty, and we try to avoid it. So these are the general guidelines. I say this as an introduction to what we want to study today. And that is that on the one hand, Tsar Bal Chaim is an Isur D'oraisa to cause the animal pain. We even have to go further and spare the animal pain if we can. On the other hand, if we need it for ourselves for whatever reason, then that overrides Tsar Bal Chaim. But in certain cases, since it's achzorius, and we have to judge each case unto itself, we have to weigh how important it is for us to achieve this goal. Are there any ways of achieving it without causing pain? And that's to avoid any sort of cruelty to animals. Susim ha-moshchim ba-gala, v'igiu l'mokom mikulkal, o lahar gavov, enim yichol limshoch b'liyeh, a mitzvah lazar. If the animal, in this case he's talking about horses, that are pulling a wagon, and they get to a place where it's very hilly, and it's very steep, it's very dangerous, or perhaps they're on the top of a mountain and they're very scared. If you can somehow help the animal, limshoch, and you can pull the animal, b'li ezer, in other words, by helping the animal, mitzvah lazar, you have a mitzvah, a command to help the animal, af l'nochri mishum tzari b'alechayim. Shalom yake osam anochri make rabba limshoch yosem esher b'kocham. In other words, if you imagine that the balagola, the wagon driver, is a guy and he's going to hit the animal because the animal is hesitating and you have a way of getting the animal to move without, you know, sparing the rod, so to speak, with saving him from the nochri who's cruel to him and is going to beat the animal to death, so to speak, then you're obligated to do so.
Well, what about if, you know, in the days when they were horses pulling the buggy and whatever, you know, and you just...
Right, no, we're not talking about, you know, just, you know, giving the animal a little bit of a smack. That the animal is used to that. It doesn't cause it any great suffering and pain. We're talking about a very extreme situation where he says, Hanochri mako so b'maka rabba. Okay, those are the two key words, maka rabba. It's a very powerful, you know, the nochri is so eager to get the animal to go over this barrier or over this hump that he's willing to beat the animal. You know, that's not what you're talking about, or when, you know, where the animal, you know, you hit the animal.
One is encouraging and the other one is torture.
Correct. So if you can step in, intercede on behalf of the animal and get the animal to do exactly what the guy, the owner of the animal, wants the animal to do, but in a sense you can spare the animal this torture, then that's included in the mitzvah d'oraisa of Tzar Balicham. You're obligated to do so. Now, in a sefer called Avne Yishpeh, Rabbi Yisrael Pesach Feinhandler, right, tells the following story. Meisa,
Feinhandler, I went to school with him.
With Rabbi Yisrael Pesach himself?
Yisrael Pesach.
Okay. He writes, Meisa v'nichnas parpar l'toch korei akavish. A butterfly got caught in spider webs. And he couldn't get out. Shalu bachurime yeshivim yesh mitzvah lahatzil sparpar mishum tzar balechayim. Is there a mitzvah to somehow extricate this butterfly from the spider webs? Nira, his response was, the ein shum mitzvah lahatzil parpar mikamatayim shezet tivam shel hachayot sheachas torefes chaverta. He says the following, that in the natural, I guess you'd call it in the wild,
environment,
one animal attacks another animal. That's the way God created the jungle, so to speak. Right? The civilization of animals is one big jungle. And we don't have to intercede and decide who we should save from who. You know, let's say, for example, you know, you witness a lion attacking a sheep or something like that. So the animal wants to attack, and that's so to speak his natural right. You don't have to intercede.
Unless and you it's don't... your sheep.
What do you say?
Unless it's your
yeah,
sheep.
Yeah, right. If it's your sheep, you might want to intercede. Although, you know, if it's a lion, you better be very careful. But the point is that within nature, there is a natural collision or confrontation between animals and birds and crawling creatures, you know, they battle each other. That's
keep the balance.
What are you saying that if, we should intercede or that or the fact wolf, that one animal kills another animal that keeps the balance?
Like for example, the wolf is almost extinct in some areas, and as a result, the entire area has gone downhill completely. And then there they brought those wolves back. And those wolves, they control the entire environment. The wolves eat this, which stops it from eating that, which keeps this, which, you know, it keeps the rivers running properly and the trees and everything, because that wolf is there to keep it.
So wait, so what's the bottom line of, so I'm trying to, you know, we're learning Tzar Bal Chaim, so what are you saying? Am I...
Well, you say if the wolf is, you know, it's good to have the wolf there to kill.
So again, I'm asking, what's my responsibility? You know, we're learning Shulchan Aruch now. We're trying to get the guidelines for what my responsibility is. So are you saying that I'm responsible to protect the wolf?
It's good to leave them alone, to let them go out and...
Ah, you're saying that if we don't interfere, that's going to be the note to be hoot about hunting, number four. But if I understand you correctly, and tell me if I misunderstand you, that if we stand by passively and let nature take its course, then there is a certain ecology, there's a certain system to nature.
Yes, Hashem has worked that out.
And
if you kill those wolves off, it's going to completely kill the area.
It's kind of similar to the following. If you know, let's say it like this. The cats are a pain sometimes, right? We live in Catamon here, so we know how many cats there are. But on the other hand, the cats are part of the system. They can kill rats and so forth and so on. So for the benefit of the entire system, we're not going to interfere and kill the rats because we need... I'm sorry, kill the cats because we need the cats to kill the rats. Let's talk a little about hunting. This is number four, the Nodav Yehuda. Somebody asked about the Jewish attitude towards hunting. And he says the following, that, are you hunting litzorech ha'adam? Are you taking balei chayim for your purposes? And you have something constructive to do with the animal. You know, you want to use its skins or its flesh, or perhaps eat it if it's, you know, if you catch it and then you shecht it, or whatever the case may be. He says, if you're killing animals just for the sake of the fun of it, and you have no constructive purpose, he says in such a case, there's an issue of Tzar Balei Chayim.
What is Tzar Balei Chayim?
Oh, so again, that's the topic of tonight's lecture, so it's good that you asked me that. Tzar Balei Chayim means that I'm responsible for the suffering of an animal. If I cause the animal suffering, that's a violation of the Torah law. So I'm glad you asked me that, because I've been talking about this for the last 15 minutes and I didn't clarify this. Tzar Balei Chayim, that's the topic of our discussion. You'll see it in number one in the Peleoids. Right? The Peleoids says, Tzar Balei Chayim Doraisa. It means we have to be very careful not to cause pain to an animal. So here I go, I go with a bow and arrow, let's say, and today, of course, there are more sophisticated ways of hunting animals, but I shoot down animals, and just for the sake of the fun of it, is that permissible? So the Yehuda says, well, let's look at it from a perspective of what a Jew is all about, and what does it mean to be an ethical Jew? So in the paragraph that starts, the Omnom the Ode, which is the third paragraph on your page, he says, "Ma'odani tomel gufa dover." I'm very surprised that you even raise this question. He says, "Lo matzinu ish tzayin." If you look into the history of our holy books, where do you find a Jew of any structure, of any stature, who's a hunter? You know who are the hunters? Nimrod and Esau. Those are the hunters. These are not upstanding giants in Jewish ethics. These are some.
Something in
Tehillim
about.
In Tehillim, you say?
Tehillim, or
I don't know about Tehillim. I'm not an expert in Tehillim. I'm sorry. I plead the fifth here. You know, if I can get through this, know the Yehuda, I'll be more than happy. He says, "Ein zed darke b'nei Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov." Hunting is not typical, he said, of the children, the descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Pokhazi.
Except for Esau.
Right, except for Esau. But he's talking about the true children of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, right? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, V'lo b'Esau, right? Whatever the pasuk there is, Zaracha v'lo kol Zaracha, right? U'pokhazi lomar chavola u'techadesh v'kosim ha'ri b'psoko v'kei hevi ha'ri that ain lomar kein al anase mi oros hem mishuv rachma val kol masov. The Torah says Verachma Valkomas that God has compassion on all his creatures. V'eich yavis ish Yisrael v'yodayim, how could a Jew possibly kill with his own hands Valichayim belishum tzorach, just because he has this desire, this chemda, to be a hunter? Miu ish hatzorach lezeh. Oh, I'm sorry. Umishu ish hatzorach lezeh. What about a person who makes a living by capturing animals and selling them on the market or giving them to the zoo, whatever he does? Parnasoso mitzeda. Kazu bazelo shayach achrois. That's not a cruel thing. If he's going out capturing animals either because he wants to sell them and that's his parnasa, that's how he makes a living, or for example he shechts animals and birds and so forth, maybe even he captures fish and he kills the fish for the purpose of human beings, he says that's something else. Mali tahorim sheyochal mibsaram, if he's eating from the flesh of the animal, that's one thing. Mali tmeim sheyochal v'yafarnis atzmo mitmeo rosehem, if let's say for example he captures non-kosher animals but he takes the hide and he sells the hide, is kol balichayim nitnu li'adam l'chol tzarchav, God created all these animals for the, whether kosher or not kosher, for man's needs. Avol misha ein zeh l'tzorach parnasaso, ein ikar kavanaso klal b'shvil parnasaso hu achzorius, that's cruelty. That is something that's absolutely foreign to the spiritual, ethical, genetic code of Bnei Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Lachem, yesh b'davar zeh mida meguna, this is achzorius, this is cruelty, and it's asur. Not only that, it has also an element of sakana, because, you know, very often a hunter might be hurt by his prey, by his animal, and therefore God is looking down at this person and judging him because he's putting himself into an undue and unjustified danger by getting into this avocation of hunting. And therefore, Hashomeli, if you're willing to listen to me, Yishkon Betach B'Sheket, he should live quietly and securely. V'eino V'Beso V'lo Ya'avid Zmano B'Dvarim Kelu, he should have a quiet, calm house, and he should not go out there and waste his time for something that's really absurdious, and he's causing undue and unjustified suffering to animals. Now, if we can close the door, I would be able to concentrate a little better. You don't mind? Just don't fall. Okay. Now, Rabbi Rucham Levavitz was the great mashgiach in the Mir Yeshiva back in Europe. And he says that we should read this Nod of Yehuda very carefully. And he emphasizes the last line in this presentation that we just read from the Nod of Yehuda. And he writes, Rabbi Yerucham, Nelcha nav nagidli akum nekuda kazos b'maisa shal tzedas chayos mipas ibud hazman. He says, could you imagine going to the non-Jews and telling them, you know what? You shouldn't be a hunter because you're wasting your time. He says, you know what the guy is going to do? Yavid olecha mishtomen. He's going to look at you like you're off your rocker, so to speak. He's in shock. Lo maven kol dibras. He doesn't understand what you're talking about. I love hunting, and you're telling me it's a waste of time?
But why would they be calling it a waste of time in the first place?
You know, the Yehuda says that when he addresses a Jew has to be very careful about his time. He has to use his time constructively and purposefully for something meaningful. And hunting is not a purpose. It's just for the sake of pleasure. Just hunt down animals for the sake of your own pleasure. So a guy thinks that's the greatest thing. You know, the hunting, you know, okay, now, again, some of the species, like you said before, are protected. But generally speaking, if you go, for example, I have an interest in art. If you look at art, some of the greatest pieces of art are taken of hunters. Hunting is like a great experience for guys. You know, they're so dedicated to hunting. They love hunting.
And there's a danger that he enjoys the kill so much, let him kill animals and not people.
Okay, maybe you could say a psychological thing, but he's saying that you go ahead and tell a person, don't involve yourself in hunting because you're wasting your time. The guy is going to look like you're crazy. But in the Jewish ethical code, where time is precious, and you're wasting your time because you have this desire to hunt and kill animals, that's a whole different concept. He says, "Im ulai yelo eza soga be'isur mitzad bali chayim." Maybe you could convince the guy that he's causing undue suffering to an animal. Maybe the guy can appreciate that. Avolo b'shum part of the ofim b'minias hatzeni mitzad inyan id b'zman. The guy is not going to give up hunting because you've convinced him that it's a waste of time. Ki al ma acheres yivakish lo behamtonis esman. What is he going to do with this time? He has to fill the empty gap. He spends every Sunday hunting, or I don't know how many hours a week. Now he has an empty period of time. Was he going to watch television?
Okay.
What?
Sometimes there comes a bee, like in Texas. There are too many deer. Basically, they set hunting season by how many deer they need to cull in order to keep the balance.
So that's something totally different.
But that's good.
But that's what Tzarcha Adam. We're talking, our discussion here in numbers 4 and 5 on your page, which is another view of this famous tshuva about hunting, is about a person who hunts an animal not because the government wants him to hunt the animal, but simply for pure pleasure. That's the way he spends his time. Now there are all sorts of pleasures in life. And some of those pleasures could be justified within the framework of psychological normalcy. You know, it's normal to want to have, you know, to once in a while relax and or go on a vacation. But to dedicate endless hours to hunting and to win the trophy, you know, the hunting trophy, how many different animals did you kill today with your bow and arrow? That's great for Esav and Nimrod, but that's not typical of a Jew. And therefore, if you're careful about reading the Od Yehuda,
that's how you decorate your house with the
with the heads of a moose or whatever you have. So the Od Yehuda wants to say the following: I can talk to you about cruelty. I can talk to you about causing undue suffering to the animal. Maybe you'll understand what I say, and maybe even a guy would understand that. But I'm going to go beyond that, says the Od Yehuda. I'm going to tell you that from a Jewish perspective, this is an absolute waste of time. There's no justification to kill your time with this. You tell this to a guy, he's going to say, wait a minute, if I stop hunting, what am I going to do with all that extra time that's on my hands? He's not counting every single moment because every single moment it can be dedicated potentially to a mitzvah, to the study of Torah, you know, to do chesed. The Torah perspective is that time is precious, and if you're doing something, you have to justify it. So again, if there's a need, like you say, because the government decided we got too many deer over here, that's something else entirely. Mm-hmm. We're talking simply about man's desire, his craving for going out and hunting animals. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a tshuva here. Let's just see what time it is. Okay, we still have 5 more minutes. And then if anybody wants to stay for Chumash, I'm going to give the shir anyway. So if you stay, you'll hopefully enjoy it. We have here a tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef in Yechavadas. And he says the following. A person had a break, his car had a breakdown, and now he's stuck on the road. And he's standing on the road, and he's just simply out of his wits. He doesn't know what to do. So the question that was posed to Rav Avadya was, is there an obligation on the drivers who are experienced drivers, they see that he's having trouble with his car, are they obligated to stop their car, you know, on the side of the road, and to whatever extent they can, to help this Jew, give him, you know, he's in a mitzuka means he's in a terribly, you know, anxious position, you know, he's in the middle of the road, he doesn't know what to do, he can't get his car working. Maybe you can help him by fixing his car, maybe you can help him and come up with some other counsel, some other wise advice for him. Maybe you'll tell him what numbers, the telephone numbers he could call, you know, different companies, Grier and so forth and so on.
Give him a ride.
Right, give him a ride so that he can come back with the fixer man. Whatever you can do, there are many different ways you can help. So it's interesting the way that the tshuva, the answer, the response of Rav Avadya Yosef was formulated. He says the following. The Rambam tells us that the mitzvah of prika, Prika means if you have an animal, a beast of burden, it has a very heavy burden on its back, and there's the owner of the animal is trying to lift this burden off the back of the animal, and there's a mitzvah, one of the 613 is called the mitzvah prika, which means to help him unload the animal. Says Rav Avadya Yosef, you could understand this mitzvah in two ways. One way to understand is that the animal is suffering because it has all this weight on its back. The other way of understanding is that you're obligated to help the owner of the animal because he's not successfully getting this burden, this package, off the animal's back.
Prika?
Excuse me?
How do you say prika?
Prika.
How do you spell it?
Again, if you look inside, you'll be able to see it. It's number six.
Number six.
The second paragraph. Second paragraph. The first paragraph is in bold print.
Prika, okay.
And you'll see on the first line in the second paragraph the word prika.
Got it.
Okay, it's one of the 613 mitzvahs. Says Rav Avadya Yosef that based on the Rambam, I can prove to you that the essence or the underlying reason for the mitzvah of prika, of helping the owner to take the burden off the back of the animal, eino bishvil tzar bali chayim, it's not only because the animal is suffering under this great weight, but the reason for the mitzvah, says the Rambam, is to help your friend. He's in a tzara, he's in a difficult strait. He doesn't know what to do, he can't get the animal moving, he can't get the burden off the animal's back, it's too heavy for him. And he's in a state called Behala. Now I'm going to try to find an English word to translate Behala. Behala is a word that means you're in a state of absolute bewilderment and confusion. You're completely overwhelmed. Are you with me on that? So now the man is in a state of Behala. He doesn't know what to do. He has no way of neither moving his animal forward to get to his destination, nor does he have a way of getting the burden off the animal. And Rav Avadya Yosef says that according to the explanation of the Rambam, of the reason and the goal of the mitzvah of prika is because of the suffering of the Jew who's absolutely bewildered, he's confused, he doesn't know what to do over, he has no etzah, he has no counsel, no way out. He says that the case of a breakdown in a car is no different than the breakdown of an animal. Meaning, it's just like the animal is not functioning because the animal can't move forward because of the weight, so too the car, the automobile, is not functioning because it has some sort of takala, which is a Hebrew word for some sort of a breakdown in the car, and it's in the middle of the road. Therefore, Rav Avadya Yosef says that for sure you have to do whatever you can to help this person who's stuck on the side of the road with a car that's broken down, if you only can help him. And as a matter of fact, sometimes a person, and he's so lost and he's so bewildered that he might get himself into real danger. You know, he might step off a little bit off the road in order to try to flag down some help, and chas v'shalom, he can get run over. So there's a dangerous situation here. So from the mitzvah prika, which applies to animals, in which you have to help the owner to remove the weight of the animals, we can extrapolate and derive the mitzvah and the obligation to help someone who's traveling and his car breaks down. And this would be a great mitzvah of chesed. Now, we don't have time to do number seven, but what we will do is we'll give a little bit of introduction. What was the question that was asked here to Rav Avadya Yosef in this tshuva? Are you allowed to go to a stadium? I guess it's like the Colosseum. You remember in Rome, they used to have a Colosseum, and they used to have wars between animals or gladiators and stuff like that. Or, for example, in Spain, they're famous for having a bullfight, correct? So somebody...
Roosters, they wanted.
Roosters, okay. But let's talk about bulls, because that's the classical case of people coming to watch animals fight each other, right? But let's say the two bulls that are fighting each other in that case.
Or a person's fighting the bull.
Well, no, in this case he's talking specifically about two bulls that are fighting each other. Okay. And he says the following. He says, if we have actively created these animals, or not created these animals, that's a bad word, but we've programmed them, we've conditioned them, we've trained them in order to attack each other, when in nature these animals would be friendly. He says that's absolutely antithetical to our holy Torah. Our holy Torah wants to see harmony. And if we train these bulls, and you know, in Spain they're experts at doing this, then the animal was trained by a human being to battle against another animal, and one animal is going to kill the other animal, maybe they'll both kill each other. This is what's called a tarbut, a culture of achzoriut, of cruelty. And it's not part of Yaakov, meaning of the ethical code of Yaakov Avinu. We were meant to be Rachmanim, and we have an Iser of Tzar Bali Chaim in our Torah. That means the Torah prohibits us from causing pain to animals, suffering to animals. The Torah therefore commands us, as we saw, to remove that burden from the animal's back if the animal is crushing, is being crushed under the burden, the weight of its animal of its burden. And now you're going to train an animal to attack another animal. And again, in nature, the animals are absolute. So this is not the case that we discussed before, where in nature one animal is toref another animal. We're talking about something that's absolutely mechanical, meaning it's been conditioned to do so. This is antithetical, he says, to the Torah Hashkofa.
What about a Rottweiler?
I don't know anything about it. I can't tell you. I don't even know what it is.
A dog that is trained to be protect.
Oh, we're not talking about
human.
We're talking about a dog that's trained to attack another dog, meaning that the dog itself.
Yeah, I got that. But what about the Rottweiler?
Well, that's something totally different. That's not antithetical. Do you think that's against the ethics of the Torah?
No, I'm asking.
Well, again, you're training a dog to protect a human being. Are you not? That's
but
again.
But also attack another one.
Another what?
Human being.
Well, who is this other human being? Is he a member of Amalek? Is he an adversary to the Jewish people?
It could be anybody that just enters the yard.
Is it again? You know, if there's someone. Like, for example, the Torah allows you to kill a burglar if he breaks into your house. Again, I'm not going into all the details.
Well, sometimes you just open the gate and come in, you know, and they don't know you, so they come after you.
Okay, well, again, every case has to be judged. I'm not here to answer your questions. You know, you'll have to address them to Rav Avadia Yosef, but it's a long-distance phone call. In any event, what Rav Avadia says is that if you artificially train an animal to become an attacker, and for no other reason than to enjoy the spectacle of watching a bullfight, watching one bull kill another bull.
A rooster fight.
Okay, whatever it is, I'm not going. He has the case here of bulls. I assume it applies to roosters as well. But basically, you're training animals to kill other animals when in nature they don't have that propensity. He says that's antithetical to what's called Tsar Bali Chaim. The Torah wants us to be careful and not have one animal kill another animal when there's no need. Again, if you have a need for it, like for example, you're training an animal to protect you, or for example, a blind person, you know, trains an animal to be a seeing eye dog, that's what we have to do. But to train an animal to attack another animal, just so that one animal will kill another animal and we'll gather together in a big stadium and we'll enjoy the sport and we'll drink a beer and we'll clap, that's antithetical to the Torah's ethics. Okay then, my friends, now I thank you for coming. I hope you got something out of it. We covered two different peleoites tonight. One peleoites, we spoke about the need or the essence of a human being, the challenge of a human being to accept responsibility for his action and not try to find alibis and excuses. And we spoke about the sensitivity that we have to have for animals, not to cause the animal any undue suffering. Okay then?